we're very pleased that Dr. Frank Press has been able to join us today, the president of the National Academy of Sciences. He was essentially first on our list of people we wanted to invite here when we began our discussions on the presidency and science advising. He operates with even more pressure than some of you, I believe, and so that arrangement was not possible. Now that he's come simultaneously, as you've heard, somebody else has arrived who has also been delayed, and so we'll have some competition. But although we've asked that this be restricted, while they've not so far cooperated very much. But I'll excuse myself if it gets too bad. Frank Press is a very respected, in fact, in the words of the U.S. News and World Report, the most respected American scientist, educator, geophysicist. He received his bachelor's degree from City College of New York, and also an honorary LLD from them, and a master's and a PhD from Columbia. He taught geophysics from the rank of instructor to full professor at Caltech and directed the seismological lab there. He was professor of geophysics and chairman of the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at MIT, and then became science advisor to the president and director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy from 1977 to 1980. He has been president of the National Academy since 1981. He participated in the bilateral science agreements with the People's Republic of China and the USSR. He's the co-author of the book Propagation of Elastic Waves in Layered Media, and also of some 160 publications. And co-editor of Physics and the Chemistry of the Earth. He's received numerous awards, including the Columbia Medal for Excellence and the Gold Medal of the Royal Astronomy Society. It's a great pleasure to have Dr. Press with us today, and we look forward to perhaps a broader discussion of science than we have had in the past, inasmuch as I think he'll range beyond the subject of science advising to the president.
Thank you, Dr. Thompson. Dr. Thompson said that I could be as informal as I like, and let me do so. I think what would be more valuable is a discussion around the table here, and so let me talk for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then all of us can have a discuss some of these issues, which I might throw out to you. Can you hear me back there?
You've got a wire.
Oh, it's wired. Okay, good.
The wire's not working. Why don't you pull up some chairs? I guess we've been... Lucian and others, why don't you come on in to the other side if you want.
There are three chairs in...
There are three chairs on this side. Lucian, there are chairs over here.
Everybody can sit.
You can bring the chairs up, and you may have to leave early, but why don't you? Why don't you just bring the chairs up to the table, and then if we have a fire, why would you can clear the whole room.
The other day, Governor Sununu, the president's chief of staff, gave a talk which I attended, and he said this. He said, there's hardly an issue that crosses the president's desk, and I see them all, that doesn't involve some degree of understanding of science and technology. And if you think about it, he's probably right. Perhaps it's a little bit of an overstatement, but think of the agenda that the president faces in his daily life. environment, issues of the competitiveness of American industry, agriculture, relations with other countries as they involve trade, especially technological trade, the entire defense budget, which in the next year or two will have to be re-examined in view of the changes that are taking place in Eastern Europe. And so the role of a science advisor assumes, I think, an unusual degree of importance. I served on President Kennedy's science advisory committee when Jerome Wiesner was science advisor, and I remember the agenda in those days. Very heavy in national defense issues, very heavy in space, because that was the beginnings of the space program and the Apollo program. But beyond that, the agenda fell off. And today, the issues that the world faces, let alone the President of the United States, involve a great deal of insight and understanding of matters that are technological and scientific. The role of the science advisor is a difficult one. I can tell you from my own experience that it's difficult. And I think that no matter who's the president, some of the problems that the science advisor faces are common across administrations. How would the science advisor be viewed? Is he a specialist? Is he the person you turn to when there's a special problem? Just as you turn to the president's physician when there's an illness, and therefore you don't involve him in policy issues or major issues that the president faces? Is he someone that is interested in the success of the administration and the presidency to the extent that he will not only be a technical advisor, but will have some degree of understanding of the politics of the presidency? That's a rather, and then therefore he crosses over from scientific expertise into the area of values and political judgments. If he or she does that, then the science advisor, I think, will be a member of the inner team, be accepted as such. On the other hand, there have been some advisors who've done that to such an extent that they have let ideology color their scientific recommendations. And so that is a continuing issue that a science advisor has to face, how to be a member of the team and yet render advice that is the best advice, technologically speaking, separated from ideology. I think Dr. Bromley is going to have to face up to that issue. He follows two science advisors who, by general agreement, have been more ideological, on the ideological side, than the other side. So it will be interesting to see how this works out. The president's science advisor today has the most powerful position in terms of standing in the bureaucracy since the creation of the Office of Science Advisor. That goes back to the very beginning. He is now a full assistant to the president, only a few of those. That means he's a member of the White House staff, not the executive office of the president. That's closer to the center of action, to the center of policy deliberations. I believe he may be the only assistant to the president who also has another job where he needs Senate confirmation. And there you have another conflict. You see, if you're confirmed by the Senate, then you have to be ready to go up and testify. And if you go up and testify, Congress will ask you about the sorts of things that are within the province of the president and his personal staff. And that's a dilemma that I think Dr. Bromley has already faced, to his consternation. the issue of being a member of the White House staff, which traditionally is not confirmed, the National Security Advisor is not confirmed, and now having an office, the director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, where confirmation is needed, and therefore he has to testify. I would like to now go a little bit broader beyond the issues of the science advisor and the presidency, sort of to give you a tour of the horizon of science and technology and related issues in the world today. Let me begin this way. The United States, by any measure, is still the world's leading scientific and technological nation. In the area of science, one way of judging that position is to look at the citations to American authors in the world's scientific literature. Not only to American authors, but to authors from every other country. Japan, France, Germany, the Soviet Union, even examining publications that are printed in other languages. Actually, that has been done. And the United States is way up high, so high in terms of citations to American authors that the graph that I remember in my head actually has to be broken to show the United States on the same graph as Japan and Germany and France. But the nation with the highest rate of increase of scientific publications is Japan. They're coming up very fast. And that's because I think the Japanese now recognize that the success formula that brought them to their present position, the success formula of the 70s, the 80s, perhaps will not work in the future. They have used technologies invented elsewhere, improved them with great art, improved them in design, improved them in manufacturability, and put them back on the market as high-quality, lower-cost products, and that's the Japanese success formula. But in doing so, they have taught the other Western nations, Western Europe and the United States, a lesson that we have to improve in our manufacturing, in our design, in our quality, in our cost, in order to compete with them. And so there's Japan, the world's a strong technological nation, and the United States a strong scientific nation, where each country has learned from the other. The Japanese have learned that they have to do better in science to compete in the years ahead, and we have learned that we have got to do better in technology and manufacturing to compete in the years ahead. And so I believe that the competition between the European community of 1992, the United States and Japan will be across the board in science and technology, in manufacturing, and all that that implies. What does it imply more specifically for the United States? I believe it implies a kind of integration of economic policy and technological policy that we have not had in the past. By that I mean, let me put it this way. We can win all of the Nobel Prizes and make all of the scientific discoveries, but if these developments don't lead to new industries or to improved industries, what good will it have done us? That's what every congressman asks me and tells me whenever I testify. And so what do we have to do to make use of our scientific strength in this country? A number of things. I believe that we need an integration of technological and economic policy. By that I mean the following. If the costs of capital are higher than those in another country, and they are, then there will be no incentives, no comparative advantage for us to develop these new ideas that we discover. Our industrial managers will see what the time scale is for return on investment, the high interest rates that they have to pay on their capital, and they will not see it in their interest to make use of our great scientific strength in terms of improving their companies, their industry. If the reward system for our industrial managers does not recognize the value of longer-term investments, which is what you need for scientific development, for the use of new technology, then again, at the level of the firm, there will be no interest in using our technological, our scientific strength. The VCRs are a good example. That technology was invented in the United States, and the Japanese didn't hesitate to spend 10 years, at least, in developing that into a better product. We didn't have the patience, the incentives, nor was it economically advantageous to wait that long and invest that much with the situation in the United States. So I believe that we need an integration of economic policy, macroeconomic policy, and technological policy to bring it all together in this country in the years ahead. I don't see it happening at the present time. Present time, we have not one economic policy or an industrial policy, but a dozen. Namely, the policies of a dozen agencies that are completely uncoordinated in the interest of what I say, the integration across the government agencies of all of this. At the level of the firm, our managers, increasingly they're beginning to appreciate the importance of research and development, of technological development. But the evaluation of a company by Wall Street does not give that company credit for R&D investments, for long-term investments in the interest of that company, except perhaps for one industry, the pharmaceutical industry. But across the board, the pressure from Wall Street for very quick returns, very rapid turnover of the investment, is antithetical to competitiveness. So this, I think, is going to be our big problem in the future. And I have proposed a new government structure where we have a national economic security advisor who has the same access to the president on these issues as his national security advisor. The president sees the national security advisor every single day, has instant access. Now, don't you agree with me that the issues of the economic growth of our country are just as important in the years ahead, and that in terms of economic and technological policy, the president's priority should be just as high? I see this as a major area for improvement in our country in the decade ahead. In fact, as a requirement, as an essential requirement, if we're going to compete with Western Europe in 1992 and with Japan for the decade or two ahead. The issue of global environment is now one that has reached the consciousness of heads of state. I was at a conference called by President Mitterrand in France a few weeks ago. President Gorbachev is having an international conference next spring. At the economic summit, this is now on the agenda of the heads of state who go to the economic summit. The global environmental issues pose the toughest policy dilemma that a public official faces. And this is the reason. We have predictions from the scientific community of the possibility of changes that are so profound that the dislocations will be unprecedented in the middle of the next century. But their predictions are full of uncertainty. They really don't know for sure. Their gut feeling is that in the next century there will be a rise in sea level by perhaps 10 centimeters to a meter. There will be changes in rainfall pattern so that there will be droughts in our most fertile regions. They will now become dry. There is the possibility of the deterioration of the ozone layer with the health effects that could be disastrous. But in detail, these predictions are very uncertain, and they wander back and forth. To make changes in our energy economy to reduce the emission of carbon dioxide will take 40, 50 years to change from a fossil fuel economy to something else, and nobody knows what that something else will be. It could cost as much as trillions of dollars. And yet, and we have to start doing these things now to be ready. And yet, because of the uncertainty, shall we invest all of this money and all of this effort and go down this road? The administration is split on this issue. And the, as you saw last week, the nations in the world, they take different positions. It was interesting to me to see that Japan, the United States, and the Soviet Union held up an agreement last week with 77 countries on the other side on beginning to limit the release of CO2 into the atmosphere. But the global environmental issue is not only a technical issue, it's also an economic issue of profound consequences. Because the even though the industrialized nations have been the leading polluters in a sense, it's the third world nations that in the years ahead, as their economies develop, and as their need for energy develops, and as the need for their fuels, the fossil, the tropical forests become even more intense, it is these countries that will become the polluters in the future. And yet, if you think of their position, here we're beginning to tell them you can't do these things when we have been the predominant polluters of the atmosphere. And not only that, we're telling them that they can't develop economically, that they have to stay where they are in the interests of global environmental quality. And so this poses a not just an environmental issue, but an issue of economic relationships between the developing world and the advanced nations, I think triggered by now this environmental concern. How are you going to tell the Chinese to stop using CFCs when they need refrigerators and refrigeration because of their food storage problem as one of their highest priorities? To switch to substitutes will be very expensive for them, and without technological help in changing to new refrigerants, without some economic help, it's not in there. It'll be difficult for them to do so. That's just China. Now think in terms of Africa and South America and other countries. What I'm trying to say is that the global environmental issue is also a global economic issue that has to be worked out. And then underlying all of this is population growth. I'm very disappointed in our own country for pulling back on the issue, in terms of our international contributions, on the issue of global population growth. Because that is, without limits on population, there's no hope in terms of solving the problems of the environment. And I think, once again, we have to play an important role in this area. It's an economic question, it's a health question, it's a technological question, and the world is going to have to face up to it. My 20 minutes are up, but I think just... what I've done is raise some of the issues for you that I think the nation will have to face in the years ahead. And I've left out education and our workforce and the poor quality of our workforce and all of the problems that we will face there. I've left out the fact that our agriculture is going to have to change because our agriculture, the most successful in the world, is now a major source of pollution. The farmers in the Midwest can't drink their own well water. They've polluted it so badly. This raises other issues for us. Let me stop there and just open it up for discussion.
If you want to just take your own question,
would you like to, would you like to see if you can sneak in
I'll
here?
I'll be an artillery watcher here.
Your comment or thought about having a an advisor on a broader base than presently constituted seems to me to be a superior one. Let's take this, you mentioned the Wall Street aspect of inhibiting the development of research, R&D primarily, and encouraging short-term planning. I don't think this is a Wall Street problem. This is a national problem. People in Wall Street are going to make a buck, and you make that buck by following the ground rules as set up on a national basis. You have the short-term point of view has been encouraged, importantly by the big pension funds who don't pay any tax. The manager, pension fund manager, works on a quarter-to-quarter basis, and it's entirely on what have you done for me lately. If he doesn't produce, he's out. So he takes every short-term move he can make in order to show up well as against his competitors. And this one important part is that we do not have a capital gains tax on the pension funds. If we had a strong capital gains tax on the pension funds for any short-term trading, that would be one big help. Then secondly, and I think equally destructive, and I think the first is a very destructive thing. Secondly, the way we have encouraged takeovers, company breakups, has been shameful. And surely some mergers are desirable, but a very high percentage of the ones we've had in the last couple of years, or 4 or 5 years, are more destructive than they are helpful, and it penalizes a corporation which builds up a strong current position and spends a lot of money on R&D. They're sitting ducks for the raiders to come in. And this is, again, is not Wall Street. This is national policy. And I think your point of the integration of national policy and the ground rules and the I think is a very important point.
I agree with everything that you've said. That's why I said it's related to macroeconomic policy. I think our tax policy, just as you've said, encourages these things. I'm for capital gains tax, but not the president's plan. I would like to see a capital gains tax where you have to hold your holdings for maybe 5 years.
I'd say even longer.
And not only for the pension funds, but across the country. I would also, the pension funds are a huge source of capital. I would also change some of the requirements in the pension funds to enable them to invest some small fraction in entrepreneurial sorts of things.
They can do it now.
In some states, California has just allowed them to do it, but I believe in other states, the restrictions are so severe that they can't take that kind of risk. But perhaps it's changing more rapidly than I know. If they can do that now, that's very good. accelerated depreciation, not just, but carefully controlled so that it's really for productivity increasing investments and tax credits for that. And then incentives for the American public to save, as there are in Japan for the Japanese public, because saving will reduce the cost the cost of capital in this country. And then it's inconceivable that a nation like ours, you know, the leader of the Western world, can't solve its deficit problem. It's just kind of a disgrace that we can't do that. And there's so many ways of doing it that have positive fallout for other reasons. When I saw the price of gasoline in France a few weeks ago, $2 more per gallon than it is in the United States. I'm not proposing this. But if we did that, we'd have $200 billion of new income. We would have incentives for energy-efficient automobiles, which we need for other reasons, environmental change and all of that. Reduce our trade deficit. Our oil imports are growing. The oil imports are the biggest fraction of our trade deficit. And there's so many good things that will fall out from that, our deficit, our environment, our everything. There are so many ways, I'm not proposing that, but there are so many other ways of being sensible in our economy, and yet we can't pull ourselves together to do it. But these are all in the category of economic policies integrated with environmental and technological policies that I think that kind of integration, as you've said, we lack. We lack in this country, we lack in the government. There's no mechanism to do it, as a matter of fact.
May I follow up on your last statement, sir? You are the head of the National Academy of Science. If, and I fully agree with you on the value of, say, a dollar a gallon gasoline tax. If you're not going to advocate it, who in the world is? I mean, a politician can't. I mean, this is, it would seem to me this is an area where scientists and technologists have got to stick their necks out. And the benefits of something like that are so very important to our country, to our economy, and to the environment. Clearly, there are some economic and political fallout issues. But if we can't say that and come out and say, stick a dollar onto the price of gasoline, be like the rest of the world, who in the world is?
It's interesting. I would do it. And I would have to stray over into the area of politics because there are some equity issues. A lot of poor people need their car, and so you'd have to have some transfer.
A food stamp.
Something like that. But as the National Academy of Sciences, the individual members can be partisan, but the corporate entity has to be sort of neutral and stick to the technology. I mean, you see, there's
is
a difference.
The
there's a difference.
Is the
technology
black and white clear?
It is. It is. I mean, if you say how much will we, how much oil are we importing? How much will that those imports be reduced if we raise? We could answer those questions, but to recommend. As the National Academy of Sciences, to make a recommendation that is political and technical is something we can't do, but the science advisor can do. If we did that, you see, we have a special relationship to the government. We're very credible. They come to us for a lot of help, as does Congress. We're a non-governmental agency with a special relationship to the government. And to keep that relationship, we have to be nonpartisan and not take on an advocacy role in the area of values or politics.
Well, I hate to keep pursuing this, but in the political...
We debate this all the time in our organization.
it is political suicide, no matter, to make such a recommendation, no matter what party you're in. So I don't, so it would seem like it would be an apolitical recommendation as opposed to partisan.
Okay. There's some scientists who agree with you and think we should do it.
I'm intrigued with your suggestion and agree with it that we should have an economic security advisor as close as the national security advisor to the president. But would he not be caught also on a dilemma, not quite the same as the other officials? Namely, clearly he would not only have to advise in terms of immediate national policy, but he'd have to advise, it seems to me, very much in terms of the global considerations that you mentioned, which might mean in the short run, at least politically, that the U.S. would have to do things, he would have to be advised to do things that would be costly, economically and politically, for the long-range benefits. I hope the courage would exist, but I could see that he would be caught very frequently on that kind of dilemma.
That's exactly right. How do you balance the expenses of some of these policies, especially when the returns will not be seen by this president or the next one, but by another generation? But that's leadership, isn't it? I mean, we need a president who has a vision, who has a goal, that goes beyond the politics of re-election in 4 years. and hope. I think, as I look at these issues, increasingly I feel that it needs a generational change in our leadership. I see some young governors and young senators in both parties who are ready to make these kinds of judgments. And I think my generation has to move out, and these younger people have to come in their 40s and their late 40s, as I say, in both parties, who I talk to them, and they, as I sense the views around this table, it's the views that they're ready to make part of their platforms. And I just don't think the 60-year-old generation in politics today, perhaps with some exceptions, is ready to make that sort of decision. Take what's happening in Eastern Europe. How much did we invest as a nation, trillions of dollars in defense, because of our concern about the Soviet bloc? Literally trillions of dollars. How much did we invest in the Marshall Plan to keep Western Europe safe from communism? Well, for the first time in how many years now, 70 years, we see that whole structure in Eastern Europe crumbling, and democratic movements everywhere, absolutely unprecedented. And what is our response? To me, it's disappointing. The Secretary of Defense says we can't let our defense down. It may be a trick. Our government offers the Poles initially $200 million. The Germans just offered them $1.5 billion to help them. Gorbachev's survival, I think, is important to this trend continuing. And he's not getting much help. He's getting more help from Margaret Thatcher, incidentally, than he is from our administration. That's disappointing to me. But I think that requires a generational change, a generation that didn't grow up in the Cold War or in World War II. I may be wrong on that, but I feel that it'll have to be the mid-90s before we get these kinds of changes, when the next generation takes over. Yes.
Going back to the matter of investment managers pursuing what you might call the Wall Street rule, their duty is to invest in a way to make the maximum return on pension funds, other funds they're managing. What about the possibility of some private group forming to try to persuade to go to the big private foundations? You see, they do not have a constituency for whom lawyers will spring up out of the woodwork, such as pension funds. If you tried to do anything dramatic that might reduce their immediate return, the private foundations could, I believe, adopt policies that they would invest to encourage and support companies that emphasize long-term R&D investments. They could do that if so minded. If they didn't let their investment managers run the show according to the typical investment manager Bible.
I'm on the board of a private foundation, and those who take care of the investments have a fiduciary responsibility. They feel they have a fiduciary and not a social responsibility. They have a fiduciary responsibility to preserve the corpus and get the most income they can. And they would say that's a responsibility they can't avoid, and they may argue against your position on those grounds.
You're in the hands of lawyers, in other words. There must be some way.
I'm not on the finance committee, but
no,
this is what they say. I might challenge that next time with your suggestion. But also, if you total the private foundations and you compare them to the totality of pension funds, say, I think you're talking about a ratio of 20-1 or more.
More
than that. And so it could only be symbolic more than anything else. If they would do, rather than economic impact, it would be symbolic impact to encourage your pension funds to do better.
Much more.
Much more than 20-1. Okay. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. My own experience has led me to feel that there's very often a major difference in point of view between physical scientists and life scientists. Among other things, that difference expresses itself in willingness to act on less certain evidence in the case of life scientists very often. And when I say act, I mean do experiments, come to conclusions, whatever. You've outlined a situation in which clearly, and of course this has been obvious also for some time, that most of the really significant and difficult problems in the next 20, 30, whatever years have a biological component. Obviously, environment, world health, whatever. Do you feel that the president is currently getting enough input from life scientists, and if not, do you have some suggestion about how this might be changed, especially in view of the fact that a lot of people who call themselves biologists these days are, and some of the best ones, are really physical scientists and are not concerned so much with complex biological situations?
That's a very interesting point. It's true that advising, science advising, has been dominated by physicists, chemists, the physical sciences. And that, I suppose, stems from the momentum of World War II, where these are the kinds of scientists who invented nuclear weapons, radar, the proximity cues, and all of these, and even in more recent times, SDI and all of that. But I think we're entering the golden age of biology right now in terms of impact, not only health and new kinds of agriculture and environmental issues, but new industries, and not just pharmaceutical. I mean, every industry will be affected by new approaches based upon, even the computer industry, based upon biological systems and our understanding of genetic of the basis of genetic change. So this is the, I think we're entering that age. And that means influence as well. Whether the biological scientist, the life scientist, has a different culture which leads to a different kind of advice, more so than the physical scientist, that's a very interesting question. And, you know, I haven't thought about that too much. There is a difference in culture. In physical science, we have very large projects, multi-billion-dollar projects. That's not the case. Even the sequencing of the genome is not that expensive. No, we have the Super Collider in Texas. That's $5 billion. We have space programs, telescopes in the $100 million class. In the biological sciences, it's more of a small scientific team. So there is that difference. Whether or not a life scientist needs less evidence to reach a conclusion than a physical scientist, you might get an argument there from a life scientist. I'd like to listen to that argument. I'm not sure that which way that would come out. But I predict increasingly that the life scientists will occupy influential advisory positions more so than ever before. It just has to happen.
Apropos of your question, in 1978 I was asked to assess the health of biomedical research in this country. This is predicated on, I was for 4 years a member of the study section on experimental therapeutics of the Cancer Institute. And from this vantage point, some of the things that have evolved from this 2-year being active in this area, apropos of your statement, I think if any place that we're preeminent as a country is in the biomedical sciences, which started as you know, just after World War II, the disturbing thing to me is the very restrictive federal policy in terms of funding research and, more importantly, the young people. For instance, right now, as you know, only 20% of the research grants that are approved are funded. But if you look below this, what is happening is that we're going to lose a whole generation of young people because of these restrictive policies. I certainly established it's extremely difficult because we have, we have overexpanded, but these special projects are cutting into the core of our whole biomedical efforts. And it seems to me, as you say, particularly in the recent events in Eastern Europe, we need to strengthen this position as opposed to being in a very crippled situation because of these restrictive policies. We're very active in this, and we'd certainly appreciate very much your input on how we best present this before Congress.
I agree with everything you're saying. When you say restrictive, you mean the budgetary issues.
Yes.
The budgetary. It is the case that we fund a small fraction of all of the proposals, research proposals that come in through the government agencies, and that a large number of excellent projects are not funded, and especially younger people just trying to get started, where they haven't built a reputation yet, they have unusual difficulty in getting funding. And this is due to a number of factors. The large projects do drain off funds, and I'm not necessarily against large projects for that reason. The number of scientists applying for grants have increased much more rapidly in universities. Not that industry shouldn't have it, but most of the research in the United States is done in the research university, and there's a problem there. I have to say that in the past two administrations, they've done their best to increase science budgets, not necessarily NIH, but the NSF, for example. But Congress has always cut them back. We've argued with Senator Mikulski, who's head of the Appropriations Committee, over and over again, and she keeps saying, look, I have a pot of money that's given to me by the Budget Committee, and I have to distribute it between the veterans, housing, and the homeless, and the scientists, all right? And it's very tough for me to do so. And she doesn't understand the argument that although we have to take care of these problems of today, if we don't make these investments to create wealth in the years ahead, we'll never get above the curve in terms of having enough funds for the infrastructure of the country, the homeless, and the other things we have to do as a nation to improve ourselves. All of this is related to economic policy, taxation, revenues, allocation of resources away from defense into some of these other areas. And this, I think, I also had this in mind when I spoke of a new generation, of a generational change in our leadership, which will be less committed to Cold War issues and the huge defense budgets, and less and more committed to the quality of life in the United States issues, where they would, with all of this, they would put more money into science. I know there's some economists in the room. I don't know what you think of some of the figures that economists have cited lately. that the government's, the return on the government's investment in science is about 28% a year. It's one of the best investments the government makes. And so it's another good argument to make with members of Congress that that this is our future. Science, technology, the health of the American people, solving some of the problems we face, and that we do need more resources, and that we're going to lose the essence of America's future scientific strength, the young people, unless we solve this problem. So I quite agree with you, but I just don't see in the year ahead, the next 2 years ahead, how we're going to get these funds that are necessary to do what you would like to do.
Well, specifically, for the sake of the audience, I think the ballpark estimate, there's something in the order of $6 billion for biomedical research, now, or $7. Mm-hmm. Now, a increment, say from 7 to 8, would, if put into this thrust that we have had, the momentum we've had for these decades, would ensure our continued preeminence globally. And is there any way that we can get through how such a small amount of the total federal budget, if given, can, I say, to me it's critical,
yeah,
that we maintain this position globally. And
I have made the same argument. What I've proposed is this. I've said that the funding of basic science in the United States is of the order of $10 billion a year, $10 or $12 billion a year. To double that over the next 3-4 years is really a trivial amount of money. I mean, $150 billion for the savings and loan institutes for the institutions. You know, for the lack of regulatory supervision. Look at the problem we have there. And then you can go on and on. The defense mistakes, which are huge. I don't mean the mistakes in the defense budget, but I mean equipment that doesn't work and planes that don't fly as they should, and so on. We're committing to a space station that's $30 billion without knowing why we want it and where it's going to go. And to double the basic science budget of the United States is just what we're both saying, is a trivial amount with enormous, actually enormous returns in health, in industrial development, in culture, all of these things, even in national security for that matter. It's ridiculous that we don't do it.
One or two more questions? Your opening remarks, you were summarizing some of our problems, you touched on one which seems to me to be so fundamental to all of the other problems, and that is the control of the Earth's population growth. We have gone from 3 billion or whatever to 5 billion or whatever in a short period of time. I'd be interested in your opinion of what happens over the next few generations or whatever, not necessarily that long, as we go from 5 to 10 billion, et cetera. Are you optimistic about what is going to happen? How are we going to deal with what looks to us now as insurmountable? We're unable to deal with it.
You can parse population, that issue of population, in a number of ways. First, the technological. I think with some more research, we could have an easy way, harmless way of controlling population. The French pill, RDU2, help me with it. It's a remarkable thing. It's illegal in this country, we can't get it in. But it's quite remarkable, a single pill in the first 3 months, and the pregnancy is terminated. It needs some medical supervision, but it's not, and it'll get better. That is, the technology will get better. So the ease of doing it, I think, will be available if it's not already available. or why isn't it being used? In many countries, in most countries, the experts and populations claim that it's an economic issue. Without the economic improvement, they will not, and education that goes with that, they will not, there's no way to force individual families to restrict the number of children. And then you have the cultural, religious aspects of it. And those are political, economic questions that will have to be solved before it happens. And they're almost insurmountable. If you start talking about a new economic order between the advanced and the poor countries, the Western nations will just flee. The leaders will flee. We can't transfer that much wealth. So I think the crisis will have to become so bad before we change attitudes, and that's what's unfortunate about it. I have no solutions.
Arnold Henry,
yes.
Could you comment on the recent tendency for science projects to be funded on a kind of pork barrel basis to the intervention of individual members of Congress? And is that really serious, or is it trivial? If it's serious, what's the scientific establishment trying to do about it?
It's very serious, and it flows from the following. Increasingly, states and regions recognize that a strong university, a strong regional technology base, turning out scientists and engineers, and helps the economic development of that region. And so a new science building, a new engineering center, a new research and development facility is viewed as an economic plus for that region in terms of industrial development. With that recognition, you're going to get every senator and every congressman, there are a few exceptions, working on behalf of a facility in that region. And most of them are leery of competitive evaluation of peer review. They feel that they will lose that competition because they can't compete with the Stanfords and the MITs and the Universities of California and other places. And so they want to bypass that system and use the political mechanism. In fact, they're not even using the normal procedure in Congress where you have hearings and testimony and some sort of evaluation. They just add it as a rider to a bill without their own process even taking place to build a facility here and a building and a laboratory there. And that's beginning to divert hundreds of millions of dollars and allocating them these funds without knowing whether they'll do any good or even work the way they want them to work. The only solution I see is to have research funds allocated in two ways. A pot of money for regional development. And there you pick the best regional development projects. And then a pot of money, much larger, where the distribution is based on the best proposals and the best work. What built the leadership role of the United States was not the political allocation of funds, but a contest of the best proposals winning out. And that's why we have the great strength that we do. And if we change that, it would be absolutely idiotic. But we need to be politically realistic that congressmen are elected to return funds to their districts, and we have to have some sort of outlet for that process to work as well. And so I'm proposing a dual track with a process for each one that everybody recognizes and adheres to.
One final question. Yes, Professor Thomas?
I'd be interested to hear your comments on science education.
Well, that's a disaster. First of all, education as a whole is a disaster area in this country, pre-college. And there's great concern that the students we're turning out of our high schools today, by and large, are not qualified to hold jobs in the kinds of industries that will be appearing in the future. Our institution put together a panel consisting of industrial business leaders who are going to do the hiring in the next decade, and we asked them to tell schools what curriculum they would like to see in the high schools in order to get the kinds of workers that they need. And they, you would expect, coming from the National Academy of Sciences, you know, the highest priority might be science and technology. No, they just wanted workers who could read and write and communicate and be flexible so that they could learn new things, because the factory floor will change very, very rapidly in the flexible manufacturing of the future. And then on top of that, they said it would be very nice if they had a little bit of science as well. So we're turning out students who really can't read, who can't learn new things, who can't communicate, and who will be unqualified for the jobs of the future as these industrial leaders see them. And that's bad. On top of that, in terms of the scientific workforce, the number of students going into science is worrisome, if you think of the needs in the years ahead. Not only that, the number of students who start in science in universities and then drop out before they get their bachelor's degree is also worrisome. What that is due to is hard to say. It may be that there are easier ways to make a living. It takes a lot, some discipline in studying. It's tough to follow a scientific curriculum. The courses are difficult. It may be that. It may be that the stereotype of the scientist is, as portrayed by the media and the TV, is not a good one. Whatever the reasons are, we are facing a shortage in our technical workforce in the beginning of the mid-90s. The NSF statistics for that are very worrisome. There are some who believe that we'll solve the problem by means of immigration. In the past, immigrants have filled important science jobs, and to a certain extent that's true. But to go into our engineering schools and see 60% of the graduate students foreigners, I mean, it really, not that they shouldn't be welcome, but it raises a very fundamental question. What's wrong with our culture and our society that are, in mathematics, more than 50% of our math graduate students are foreign students? What's wrong with our society that in science and engineering, these important areas for our future are not attracting our best students? I don't have all of the answers for that, but it's a serious problem. It's a crisis.
I'm sure we all thank Dr. Press very much for this presentation. We're sorry about the interventions from the North Flank, but you've overcome them, as I've seen you do in other circumstances, Eddie. Limitations to your presentation. As usual, it was clear and